I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are joined by Miriam Gerba, who is here to discuss her powerful new essay collection, Creep, Accusations and Confessions. It examines insidious and toxic oppression, which creeps its way through our culture via individuals, groups, and systems, and it happens all with our own form of audience participation. Miriam and I talk today about audience, gendered violence, and the gossipy nature of criticism. Don't forget, our September book club pick is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dieterer. Brittany Luce and I will be back to discuss the book on Wednesday, September 27th. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. Oh, and while you're there, be sure to leave The Stacks a rating and a review. I haven't asked for one in a long time, but it really does help the show out. September marks 2 years of making The Stacks as an independent podcast. I am so, so, so grateful to be able to make this show that I love the way that I want to, thanks to the support of the Stacks Pack on Patreon. This community not only gives me space to hire a team of incredibly talented folks, hi Christian and Lauren, it also provides me a community of so many other book lovers to engage around books, politics, and of course, snacks. The Stacks Pack has allowed me to push my thinking to boundaries I never knew possible. So if you like this show, or you like books, or you like snacks, and you want to be a part of a community that is excited by all of those things and a lot more, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. It is just $5 a month, and you get to be part of making this show possible. Plus, you get perks like our virtual book club meetups, our Discord that has the best book recommendations ever, and our monthly bonus episodes, which currently have been audio from our tour stops, which are amazing. And of course, you get shout outs on this very show. So shout out to our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Tara, Catherine McGinnis, and Ada Norris. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack. And thank you again to every single person in the Stacks Pack. You are what makes this show what it is. To join us, head to patreon.com/thestacks. And remember, it is never too late to support the people who are making the work that you love. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Miriam Gerba. All right, everybody, I am so excited today. I am joined by Miriam Gerba. She is the author of a brand new book called Creep. It's an essay collection. I'm going to let her tell you all about it, but just know it's very, very fantastic. Miriam, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you. I'm so excited to talk with you.
I'm excited too. And you're an Angeleno. I live here in LA as well.
Yeah.
So we have this in common. So just to get people started, in about 30 seconds or so, can you tell us about the book?
Yes. So the book is an essay collection. In some ways, it is both prequel and sequel to my memoir, Mean. And I largely wrote it in response to a question that I got a lot when I was doing press for Mean, which is, was writing Mean a cathartic or healing experience? And it wasn't either of those things. And I wanted space to be able to answer that question in a very full and meaty way. And so that answer grew into Creep.
How did you answer that question in the moment on book tour? Like before you had the time to sit down and do all of this work to write Creep?
Unfortunately, I couldn't answer that question honestly because I was in a relationship involving domestic violence and my abuser would listen to my press.
Got it.
So I needed to manipulate sort of my press so that I wouldn't make him angry and he wouldn't harm me.
Got it. Got it. And you talk about that in detail in that final episode, final essay Creep. I'm like such a podcaster. I'm thinking an episode, final essay Creep. I'm curious when you're putting this collection together, how much are you thinking about this through line? How much are you thinking about the essays being like telling a bigger picture versus how much are you thinking about like, I like this piece of writing that I've done and I feel like it sort of fits?
I write and edit very intuitively. Mm-hmm. And so I go with my gut. And if I have a sense that a piece or an idea belongs to sort of the project that I'm creating, then I move toward it. And so all of the pieces are there intentionally, although sometimes as I'm choosing them, it's not until I'm deep in them that I understand why I want them to be present in the project.
And as you're putting the collection together, does it ever change the essay? Are you ever like, oh, I should talk about this thing in this essay that maybe you weren't prepared to?
Yes, absolutely. Like an example would be, I really wanted to include an essay about my cousin's experiences with criminalization. Mm-hmm. And I also have an essay on Didion.
Right.
And when I was revising the essay on Didion, I saw connections that I could make with the essay that I wrote on my cousin's criminalization. Mm-hmm. And so I would find ways to stitch essays together thematically as I was working through revisions.
Interesting. I'm still sort of stuck on this, that where this book came from. Are you familiar with the essay collection Reckonings by Lacey M. Johnson?
Yes.
Hearing you say that your collection came out of this question you were getting on book tour reminds me so much of The Reckonings. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about The Reckonings. And so it's just so interesting because her second book, her memoir about the abuse that she suffered, led people to ask, well, what do you want to see happen to the man that did that to you? And then she wrote this essay collection, Reckonings. And I don't know, I keep thinking about this idea of like, what it's like to maybe be on a book tour when the thing that you've written is such a traumatic experience. Yeah. And then to have strangers like ask you, like, what is that, I guess, feel like, or what does that do to you as a creative person, like that sparks this second book, I guess?
It really annoyed me to receive or to be asked whether or not writing about sexual violence was healing or cathartic. And I think that we should refrain from making assumptions about artists and refrain from assuming that the creation of a work of art is an inherently cathartic experience. There's this myth
that equates
the two, which is so strange to me. I'm not sure like what the origins of that myth are, but That myth reverses the role of artist and audience. Catharsis is intended for the audience. And yet there's this heavy emphasis placed on the artist pursuing it. And so it was an annoyance with that question that prompted that. And when I worked on Mean, the memoir, I found myself becoming re-traumatized. Because there were details of a sexual assault, a serialized sexual assault that happened that I detailed in Mean that I didn't know. So when I researched that, I opened some old wounds. And so it absolutely was not a healing experience to work on either of the books.
Right. Do you think that the reason people assume that about artists is because there's some maybe sense of enjoyment as an audience member in that catharsis that the audience has. And so they want that to be true for the author because otherwise they feel bad.
That's an interesting question. And I think that this desire that perhaps the artist is sharing in the pleasure of the audience motivates that assumption. I also think that this myth has grown out of the popularization of self-help, that somehow art is a form of self-help therapy.
Interesting.
And it can be used that way, but it has to be used that way with a lot of intention and with a lot of other supports to throw yourself into sort of the writing of a work and the excavation of trauma. Is also a great way to really hurt yourself.
Right. Yeah. Well, that literally brings me to the next question I have written down, which is, how do you know when you, Miriam, are ready to write about a thing? How much time, therapy, drafts? I know that in one of the essays you talk about how you were preparing to write Mean and you were doing all these writing exercises for yourself around writing about this, you know, traumatic event that occurred. I'm wondering now, you know, years later, I'm assuming you've matured or something. I don't know. That's an assumption maybe I shouldn't make. But, you know, it's years later. How do you know when you have the distance? What did you learn maybe from writing Mean and being re-traumatized that you took with you this time? You know, I guess all of those sort of questions.
So I'm compelled to write about ideas, subjects, when I obsess over them.
Okay.
When they won't let me go, so to speak. That's when I really, really, really understand that this is something that I should be focusing on. This is something that I should be exploring through an essay. And writing essays is one way for me to think through problems. So for me, essays are like math equations. Okay. And I'm trying to solve for X and I'm trying to solve for Y, but I do that through prose as opposed to algebra.
Yeah. And is there a point at which you know that you're ready to release it into the world to allow people like me or people at book events to then ask you asinine questions about your life?
I mean, I never feel like my work is ready to be released into the world. I feel like I have to let go of it because if I could, I would revise work until I died. You know what I mean? I'm that devoted to it.
Yeah.
And so I have to be pried away by other people from the work. I have to be told to leave it alone because I just want to fiddle with it. I'm a compulsive tinkerer.
Okay. I get that. And is that person your editor or do you have a writing group? Who do you trust with your stuff? Your editors.
Typically editors, yeah.
You mentioned the Didion essay, and I'm so curious to you what you think makes her worthy of being dissected and talked about so much.
I think that any person who is dubbed sort of the queen of a region deserves dissection, right?
Yeah.
Anybody who's deemed a royal in any sense, I think should be dissected. And part of the project of Creep was examining individuals who I've held at various times in my life in high esteem and then removing them from their pedestals. And so Didion is one of those figures. And I also wanted to communicate to the audience that Creep is a gender neutral concept.
Yeah.
And so we have these female figures that inhabit that realm as well. And, you know, and one of those female figures is Didion.
Do you think that we have a current Didion? Is there a current king or queen of California, West Coast literature?
I think it's still Didion.
Still her.
Yeah. Like she's so incredibly beloved. There's a retrospective on her right now in LA at the, I think it's the Hammer. So she continues to occupy that position.
She continues to reign.
Exactly.
It's so interesting because I'm a Californian and my first time ever reading Joan Didion was The Year of Magical Thinking. Mm-hmm. And when I read it, it had just come out. I think we like got it at Costco. Remember when Costco used to have like tons of books? And I read it and my mom read it and I didn't know who she was. I'd never heard of her. Uh-huh. Like it had never, and it wasn't until I started doing this show. Obviously after I read the book, I read some other things by her and I'd heard of her, but it wasn't until I started doing this show that I realized how important she was to so many people.
Yeah.
Like I just thought of her as like, oh, she wrote this book about grief. Turns out apparently she'd been writing before that. Who knew? You say that like what she doesn't say is something that's really interesting to you. What are you not saying in your book that we should be interested in?
You know, I wanted to give more details regarding certain figures that I write about in Creep. Mm-hmm. I wish that I could name them, and I can't do that. And that's really painful. It's really painful that those of us who have suffered gender-based violence are counseled against naming who harmed us, and are counseled to protect people who've hurt us for legal reasons. And so I wish that I didn't have to withhold that information. I wish I didn't have to withhold identity.
Yeah. Another figure you write about in the book who I don't know if it's just what I've been reading and listening to recently, but has, I feel like is having a cultural renaissance in a way, is Lorena Bobbitt.
Yeah.
I feel like, I know you said that you write out things when they obsess you. So I'm wondering if you've noticed that she's like been around more.
Yeah. I mean, I did notice that she's been around more through the Netflix docuseries. There was a Netflix docuseries about her that was created by Jordan Peele.
I didn't see that.
Which, I mean, seems ideal considering that's a true like horror story, you know, and that's the genre that he tends to work in. But yeah, I'm enthusiastic about this attention that she's getting. But she's been a figure who I've been sort of entranced with across my lifespan for the reasons that I write about in the book, because she was the first person who indicated to me that sexual violence could happen in the context of a marriage. And she fought back and used violence in order to defend herself. And then she was also incredibly compelling to me when I was a kid because she looked like my mother. Mm. And so I would see this woman on TV and I would think that this woman looks so much like my mother. I should be paying attention. I need to be paying attention to what people say about her and how people respond to her.
Yeah. It's so, I mean, one of the things that you talk about in the essay and that I have learned about her as an adult through other things, though I haven't seen the Jordan Peele, but I now will watch, is that I didn't realize that she was an immigrant to America. I think because her last name in the news was Bobbitt, her married name. And, you know, I was young when that happened. I just assumed she was like some white lady, you know, and I had no idea about her story. And I think what's been really powerful about your essay that talks about her sort of as like this patron saint of like battered women or whatever, is that she had a whole story and she had a reason for what she did, because how it was portrayed in the news at the time and like on late night was that she was a wackadoodle who chopped off her husband's penis for funsies. Mm-hmm. And like, it super wasn't that. And I think for me, like becoming, you know, not becoming, I'm an adult now, but like, as I continue to become smarter and more mature and more critical in my thinking, I think like these kinds of figures are so deserving of reconsideration and redemption and also like a cultural apology or something, yeah. Though I don't know that that's, I don't know that that means anything, but I think that it's important, you know? That's not a question, just a comment. But I guess, like, what are you hoping that your audience is going to be considering or revising for themselves when it comes to these incidences of violence against women? Because that is definitely like a through line throughout the book.
Yes. I mean, every piece in the collection in some way addresses either directly or indirectly gender-based violence. And what I hope that readers can see is that I'm attempting to fuse the macro with the micro. And I'll give an example of what I mean by that. So in the title essay, Creep, I detail my experience of entrapment within like what's popularly called like a domestic violence relationship, although I prefer the terms intimate authoritarianism or coercive control. And I do not reflect on what might have caused me in terms of like a psychological profile to become entrapped. I focus specifically on the steps taken by my abuser to entrap me. And so I describe what that process feels and looks like, and how intentional it is on the part of the abuser, that this isn't something that happens accidentally. It's something that happens according to strategy. But then I also attempt to demonstrate how there are these larger social structures that pushed people who belong to minoritized genders into these intimately authoritative relationships. For example, I get pink slipped and I lose my employment. So that leaves me without income. Mm-hmm. And that leaves me potentially with the inability to pay rent. So when an abuser says, well, stay with me until you can get on your feet, we've got both interpersonal violence interacting with the violence of capitalism to entrap somebody. And so what I'm doing is I'm offering the reader all of these pieces, almost as if I'm giving them an assemblage, and the reader has to connect the pieces in order to understand how I arrive at the state of entrapment.
Yeah. That essay is, it's very, very incredible. I feel like it's just like, talk about Jordan Peele real life horror movie. I mean, it definitely feels like a horror essay. I think a lot of the essays read sort of like horror or thriller.
I wrote it as a horror essay. And I have long thought that the conventions that are offered to us and given to us by the horror genre are ideal for writing about gender-based violence.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, I can take these devices and I can take these tropes and I can adapt them to nonfiction. And so that's what I did, is I attempted to write horror and thriller essays. Yeah. I don't know how well I succeeded, but that was what I was attempting to do in craft.
I don't know that I would have used the word horror if you had just mentioned Jordan Peele, because I'm not a horror person. But as soon as you said that and I started talking about the essay, I'm like, oh, sure, that's exactly what I was reading. And I like to say that I can't read horror because it gives me nightmares. But I also am like a passionate nonfiction reader of the deepest, darkest things. And I'm wondering like if it's just the style of horror that makes things difficult for me as a reader versus the actual content of like horror. Because I feel like I can take like the horror of that happens in your story and in a lot of the stories in your book or the essays in your book did not give me nightmares.
Yeah.
But then I think about like how I felt as I was reading, especially the last essay, and being like, I hate it here. Like, I don't want to read this. You know that feeling where you're like watching or reading a thing, you're like, I don't want to be here, but I'm also like definitely not putting this down anytime soon. So I don't know. It's really interesting. I'm just like pondering horror in nonfiction.
Yeah. I mean, when I had begun to think about Creep, the title essay, and what length it would be, whether or not it would be standalone, whether or not it would be like a full length manuscript or just a shorter essay, as I began to think about that, I started to think in terms of genre. I knew that I wanted to write nonfiction, but I wasn't necessarily sure like what kind of like structural or stylistic strategies that I would use. And my mind immediately went to gothic fiction and gothic tropes, because gothic fiction tends to situate the horror in the domestic space. Mm-hmm. If we think of Wuthering Heights, right? That sort of gothic fiction, you've got these brooding, dangerous male characters, and you tend to have a woman trapped alone in a ruinous place. What does that sound like?
Sounds like, yeah, that's exactly right. It's, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm having a moment right now of like all of your students that you talk about in the book. I'm like, I get it. I get why they liked you as a teacher. Like, you're totally connecting all these dots for me. Okay, wait, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. I want to keep talking about the title essay, Creep, mostly because I guess I really want to talk about the title itself. How did you decide that that essay would be the title essay, and how did you decide where it would go in the collection? Because so often I feel like with essay collections, it's the first essay that's often the title essay. So I'm wondering what you were thinking with that.
So I'll talk a little bit about the genesis of the essay and then the attraction to the word creep and then its placement. So the night that I escaped from my abuser, a dear friend who defended me finally used language that identified him for what he was. And when my friend did that, there was, this is going to sound silly, but there was almost a sense of his spell being broken. Because nobody had used language to describe him accurately. Right. He'd always been a good guy, a great guy. And now suddenly there was somebody telling him that he was a creep. And that word was so succinct. It so encapsulated the way that he entered into my life with strategy and the way that he slowly began to drain me and slowly began to kill me. Mm-hmm. And so it was the shouting of that word that I think helped to sort of begin to liberate me linguistically. And I wanted to hold on to that word and keep that word and use that word as kind of like a North Star to guide me in the drafting of that piece, but also in the creation or revision of the other pieces that make up the collection. And then the reason that that essay was placed last, the reason is that when I finished writing it and started to show it to people, my readers had a very difficult time with it. I had readers who had to read it incrementally. They had to read it in pieces.
Okay.
And they had a very difficult time discussing the content of it with me because the violence was difficult for them to stomach. Mm-hmm. And so once I had that experience with some readers and editors, I came to understand that if I were to place creep at the beginning of this collection, it would cast a shadow that I figured it would cast a shadow that would make it nearly impossible for some readers to be able to interact with the subsequent pieces. Because they might have mental images, right, of what happened to me that would be sort of intrusive. And so what I wanted for the reader to do was to get to know me first and in some ways become intellectually intimate with me and sort of psychologically intimate with me, and then offer them that essay. And I think it's much more challenging for the reader to enter into that essay once they know me, at least my writing persona.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if I'm playing a compassion game with people, right? Like, first you're going to get to know me, now you're going to know me at my worst, but I'm saving the worst for last.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was such a smart and like spot on decision by you to put that essay last. I also think, just as the way that I read, you know, I love to, like, I'm always looking for the title in a book.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for it. And, you know, I looked at the essay list of like the table of contents or whatever, and I saw that it was the last essay, and I was like, huh, interesting. I have to finish this book. Like, I literally was like, I have to finish this book just so that I can find out. But the other thing about the title that I thought was really interesting, and this is, again, I think just how I entered into it, is it had never occurred to me that the word creep was being used as a noun. I had always thought of it as a verb from when I picked up the book, as I was reading through it. When your friend uses that phrase and says, like, he's a creep or you're a creep or whatever, it took my breath away, because I was like, I had not for one single solitary second, because I never read the back of the book or the blurbs. I try not to do that. And so it never occurred to me that a creep was a person, even though I have used the word as a noun many times. But like, there was just something about the way that the title landed for me that I was like, holy shit, it's a person. Yeah. Of course it's a person.
Yeah.
Like, just, it was really like very powerful. And I'm assuming from what you've just said that that's similar to how you felt when your friend used the word. I don't know that every reader will be as like naive as me or like as kind of spacey as me. I'm sure some people will be like, oh, a creep is a person. But I don't know. It just, it totally worked. And then I
really
guess,
enjoy those kinds of multifaceted words.
Yeah, same.
I really enjoy them, especially for titles.
Yeah.
I did something similar with the memoir Mean. A lot of people assumed that mean was mean as in like sort of petty cruelty. Mm-hmm. But I also titled that book Mean because I was trying to find meaning in having experienced a sexual assault.
Mm.
So creep is functioning similarly in that, yes, we have a creep and we have multiple creeps, but we also have creep functioning as this invisible action verb.
Yes, this like creeping.
Mm-hmm.
Which again kind of ties into the horror, right?
Exactly.
The like creepy.
Exactly.
I feel like I'm having like epiphanies as we're talking. I'm so glad we're doing this. This is like very cathartic for me. I know not for you, but for me, I'm having a great time over here. This is really fun. Speaking of fun, you write reviews. Famously, you had a scathing, I think is the word that people use, review of American Dirt. You have an essay about American Dirt in the book. I'm wondering if you always knew you wanted to include American Dirt in this book, or if you thought that maybe you wouldn't, just because that was like a thing that a lot of people knew you for, or like came to your work through.
I went back and forth about it. I wasn't sure. I thought that I might exclude it. And then at the last moment, I decided to include it. And I wanted to include it because I did think that it did play into the theme of creeps and creep mm-hmm. culture, right? And we have this figure who I describe as this well-intentioned white savior. Mm-hmm. And I categorize her with these creeps as a result of including the essay that I wrote about her in the collection. And I kind of think of that piece also as like a companion to the Didion piece in some ways.
Yes, where
we
totally.
Have different writers who are white or white adjacent writing in these harmful ways about racially minoritized people. And so I think of those two as sort of companions to one another.
Yeah, they're definitely in conversation. And I think one of the things you say is that literary criticism is a form of gossip or chisme. And then in another part of the book, you say that analytic essays are autopsies.
Yes.
And I thought that was really interesting because I feel like in the book, in Creep, I got to see the difference of how you think of those two things because you had included that essay about American Dirt. And I felt the like sort of gossipy vibe of that essay as compared to perhaps like the essay on your cousin or the essay, like the creep essay or the essay on Lorena Bobbitt or even like the earlier essays. Those ones had much more of like a like you said, tinkering feel or like much more of you sort of like going in and picking things apart. And I loved that feeling of like the gossip. Like I love gossip. What can I say? But do you actually think, like, is there a lens that you switch for yourself when you're writing something where you know it's criticism versus like analytic? Or is that just naturally how you sort of approach those things that are slightly different?
I think it's a matter of approach because the aim is different. For example, you were mentioning the essay on humor and mm-hmm. how I write that analytic essays are autopsies. And that particular essay is one in which I'm trying to understand certain popular tropes about humor and sexual violence. And so the tone of that essay isn't as biting as the tone mm-hmm. of the American Dirt essay. But the American Dirt essay was written with a very specific audience in mind. It wasn't necessarily written for a non-Latina or an Anglo or Angle audience. It was written for other Latinas, sort of along the lines of, pss, 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 let me tell you about this book that I just read.
Right.
And there were plenty of like non-Latinas who also seemed to enjoy the review and who shared it. but they were not my intended audience. And the way that I sort of think about that is, you know, I'm having this party. You can come to the party. If you wander into the party, that's fine.
Right.
Behave yourself or I'll kick you out of the party. That's right. Sort of how I conceived of the American Dirt essay. It was a very specific invite list.
Well, then how do you think about audience for this book?
So the audience for this book, so I think of the audience for this book as being former students. I always think of my former students as potential audience members or potential readers, I should say. And I'm also writing for women who are in the midst of surviving domestic violence or who have survived it. So I often have survivors in mind as my audience.
I have a new theory about audience and writers. I've never talked about this on the show before, so people who are listening are going to get an insight to how I think about this stuff. But I have come to the decision, based on talking to hundreds of authors, that authors who don't think seriously about audience, the books don't work.
I get so frustrated with authors who tell me that they do not have audiences in mind when they write.
I can tell.
If you don't have an audience in mind, then you're a diarist.
Yeah, I can tell.
Because writing for yourself.
Right. Either when an author says, I'm writing for myself, ugh, or I'm writing for everyone, I'm like, yeah, bitch, I can fucking tell that's what you're doing.
Exactly. It affects what's on the page.
It does, because
it's a mess.
Right. And like you were saying, it's that invitation. Like, mm-hmm, I might not have been a former student of yours and I might not be in the midst of domestic violence, but knowing that you are writing something clearly, I can see where I fit in or don't fit in. Right. And like, I think as a reader, or, you know, I feel this way about television shows. I feel this way about podcasts. I feel this way about live events. If you're not clear that there is an audience and who those people are or who you would like them to be, it's not specific. It's murky. Yeah. It's muddy. And I just, like, hearing you say that so specifically, I'm like, right. And that's probably why I fucking love this book, because I felt like, you feel taken care of as the consumer, ooh, of the thing. You feel like, okay, this person knows what they're doing. They have a plan. They have a vision. They are conveying a message to someone. And whether I get it all or not is a me thing.
Yeah.
But it makes me feel like I know you know what you're doing.
Yeah. And I think that in my case, I don't know, you know, I can't speak for other writers who have a clear vision of audience. But in my case, I think that clear vision of audience comes from having been a high school teacher for so long. Mm. If you walk into a classroom full of 16-year-olds without a vision of where you're intellectually taking them, they will take you somewhere. You right. know what I mean? And right. you can't let them take you anywhere.
Right. Do not go with the 16-year-olds.
Exactly. And so you need to have a plan. And if you go in there without a plan, they will smell the blood. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, totally.
They're like sharks, and I love them. And so yeah. you have to go in there prepared. And so I think that, like, the preparedness that working with teens instilled in me also impacted the way that I approach a page. That a page is a structured place. A page is not wild, you know?
Yeah, totally, totally. I think my feelings about audience come because I was a theater major. And mm-hmm. so theater is live. There is an audience. Without yeah. an audience, there is no theater, right? And so I think that I always think about audience because I know as a performer what it felt like.
Yes.
What it feels like. And I think it's that same sort of thing of what you're yeah. saying is, like, you need structure. You need all of these pieces in place. You can't just, like, go out there and be naked on a stage. Like, it's a no. That's terrifying for everyone. Nobody likes that. And just like teenagers, you know, I have little kids. Kids, teenagers, adults, we like structure. We like being taken care of. Like, the reason that teenagers go crazy on teachers who don't have a plan is because they're stressed out. They're like, this feels horrible for me too.
It's like free fall. Free fall's not enjoyable. Like, come on. I think one of the other reasons that, like, I have a sense of audience is that I intend for a lot of my written work to also be read aloud. And so every single piece that I write, I have to read aloud. until it clicks, until I'm satisfied with the rhythm and with the music of it. So I'm preoccupied with the musicality of my prose, and I'm also preoccupied with keeping the audience with me.
Yeah.
And so there are all these tricks that you can develop as a writer, especially a writer who like enjoys taking the stage, that keeps your audience with you. It's kind of like you're this shepherd and you always have to make sure that they're there. And so there are these various strategies, you know, and one of the strategies that I rely on a lot is humor. Because humor wakes people up.
Yeah.
You want your audience to be awake.
Yeah, totally. Well, what do you say about the joke? You say, shit, I wrote it down because I thought it was so great. Oh, you say that jokes reorganize social space, that they're not meant for laughs necessarily. It's that reorganization. Can you talk a little about that? Because that like struck me.
Sure. So I have an essay that's on humor and sexual violence. It's called Slimed. And I wrote that essay because I was very bothered by certain statements that were very critical of the fusion of humor and horror. And so I wanted to understand where my annoyance was coming from. And one of those statements is this one. So a person, a cis man makes a misogynist joke and somebody counters, that's not a joke because it's not funny. That retort, that's not a joke because it's not funny, is really bothersome to me.
Sure.
Because bigots can have a sense of humor too, right? Mm-hmm. And to a bigot, a misogynist joke is going to be funny. And to somebody who's not a bigot, it's going to be unfunny. But that does not change whether or not it's a joke. And I think that often what's going on in that scenario where the retort is this isn't a joke is that a person is attempting to like quote that statement with a certain kind of seriousness that's already present, because the misogyny is what indicates that the joke should be taken seriously. We don't need to unjoke the joke.
Right.
To take it seriously. And that's why I write that a joke can also be a death threat. And so that essay is a call to take humor in the context of gender-based violence extremely seriously, because it gives us clues about what might happen to a woman. And so that statement, those types of statements bothered me. And what also bothers me too are a lot of the storytelling habits around sexual violence. Those of us who chronicle our experiences of sexual violence, there's a lot of discomfort around fusing that storytelling with humor. And there's almost a template that's been developed that we're expected to follow, where we describe sexual violence in these nearly like reverential terms, and all humor is purged from the narrative. Or there might be like small flashes of humor, but survivors are not encouraged to use humor to sustain an entire narrative on sexual violence. And I think that inhibits some people's ability to heal, because for some of us, we're entirely reliant on that. The humor is what protects us. The humor is what allows us to approach the memories. And so I wanted to complicate people's understanding of humor.
Right. Yeah. I that essay I really, really, really loved. I think also, you know, for me as a Black woman, I think like, you know, this book is about sexual violence and gendered violence, but I think like racism as well. Like I think, you know, people of color, I can speak for my community, Black people, like we use jokes constantly to not only like survive racism, but also to explain it, to make sense of it, to navigate it. And hearing you say, you know, that people who have experienced sexual violence or gendered violence or whatever are encouraged not to use jokes and not to like employ those tactics, it's like makes me feel very sad.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like very not disappointing, but like depressing. Like it's very deflating is maybe a better word, because I know how powerful humor has been for me in those spaces. I want to shift a little bit to your process mm-hmm. about like how you actually write. Where are you? How many hours a day? How often do you listen to music? Are there snacks and beverages? Are there rituals? Like, set the scene for us.
So my writing practice has shifted in these like absurdly dramatic ways over time. What I'll do is I'll kind of restrict my description to the writing practice that I used for Creep.
Okay.
Because each project and each book has its own practice that I develop through trial and error as I'm working on the project. So when I was working on Creep, what was extremely challenging for me was that I was still very raw from what I had experienced. So I still had a lot of healing to do from my experiences of domestic violence. And that's going to be a lifelong quest. But I would say that I was like intensely raw when I sat down to write that title essay. And so I was engaging in therapy. I see a therapist once a week, but then there are all these other sort of like therapeutic modalities that I incorporated into my domestic life. Like I had to reclaim the domestic sphere as my own. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of altar work. I have various altars in my home. And so I did a lot of ancestral altar work, which also wound up being connected to the writing of Creep. And there's like a really strong ancestral presence running through it. And I didn't anticipate that my ancestors would assert themselves this strongly, but they did. And so they were walking with me as I was journeying through the project. And so I would appeal to them regularly through ritual. And I'll give an example of how I would appeal to them through ritual. I have an essay about my relationship with my grandfather, who was, he claims to have been the first publicist in the city of Guadalajara. But you know, it's difficult to ascertain like how much truth there is to that statement because he was a publicist.
Right.
Publicist to fluff himself up.
Yeah.
So he was this dynamically strange figure who inspired me as a writer, but he was also profoundly misogynistic. And so I try to grapple with that legacy. And as I was doing that, I would pray, I would light a candle for my grandfather. And then what I would do is I would take essays of his that had been published in Mexican newspapers, and I would cut them into strips. And then I would use different techniques to rearrange the strips. So I would ask him questions and then have him answer using his own words.
Wow.
So almost like a homemade Ouija board, in a sense, using my grandfather's essays. So that's partly how that essay was generated, was by inviting him to participate through the rearrangement of his own writing.
Wow. I've done this for years. No one's ever given me an answer even close to that. Normally I'm pushing people about snacks and beverages, but I feel like you've given me so much today, I'll let you off the hook on that one. That's wild. I mean, it's like so creative. How do you even like know to do that? Like
so that inspiration came to me because I have my grandfather's writings. So I have some of his writings, and I wanted to communicate with him directly, but I can't do that because, you know, he's in the spiritual world now. So when I was working on the essay Tell, which features the figure William Burroughs.
I love that one too. I loved every essay. Every time you bring one up, I'm like, oh my God, I like that one a lot.
I remembered that Burroughs had developed these cut up techniques for divination. So he was a practitioner of magic.
Got it.
And so he used these cut up techniques where he would take newspapers, for example, slice them, cut and paste them, and then use what he had created, this new assemblage, as like a divinatory tool, and as an artistic tool, a tool of inspiration. So what I did was I took that magic tool and then I applied it to my grandfather.
Wow. Okay. This is like sort of a spacey question, I guess, but How much, what I'm hearing, all the things I'm hearing you say, I'm thinking, you know, if I were in your position, I would never be able to move forward because I would have so much doubt around what was coming to me. So how do you embrace trust? Because it sounds like that's a huge part. You trust yourself, you trust, you know, your ancestors, you're trusting Burroughs's techniques. Like, how do you know to trust things when you're taking so much in as you're creating?
So I have learned to feel a sense of correctness or rightness or goodness in my body. And so, and it's very centered sort of in my stomach.
Okay.
And so I have to pay close attention to my body and I'll get, I guess, what you could call like a just right feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And once I have that sensation, and it doesn't need to last, but once it's sort of clicked, I'm at peace and I can move on. And I might still have some apprehension and some fear, but once I've achieved that, even if it's a flash, I know that I can move forward. So I wait for that.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then speaking of incorrectness, what's a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Tomorrow.
Oh, you're in the tomorrow. The tomorrow is a popular word on tomorrow and restaurant.
Because there's the M's, yep, and the W's
and the R's.
Any M's or R's. Yeah. Tomorrow is a hard one.
Tomorrow's super hard. Okay. For people who love Creep, what are some other books you might recommend to them that are in conversation with your work?
I think that if people are interested in understanding some of like the more esoteric elements of Creep, I really strongly recommend that they read Juan Rulfo's Pedro Páramo, which is a Mexican novel that some literary historians say established magic realism. And the novel has a really, really, really difficult structure. It received really mixed reviews for its difficult structure when it was first published, but it is entirely narrated by the dead. And it is structured like an assemblage. And in some ways, Creep borrows from that structure, where I'm trying to build a world, but instead of building that world through like speculative fiction, I'm building that world through essays. And so I would invite people to read that work.
Okay. And then I don't normally ask people this, but you were a high school teacher. I ask people this on a different kind of episode that we do, but I'm going to ask you today, what's the book that you teach high school students that you enjoy teaching the most? And what's the book that you teach high school students that they enjoy the most, if there's a difference?
So that's a difficult question for me to answer, because when I taught high school, I didn't teach English. I taught history, civics, and economics. So I didn't teach literature.
Oh.
I didn't assign, yeah. I'm in the
I just assumed you were an English teacher.
Social studies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then what parts of like history did you find to be like the most engaging for you to teach young people?
Young people wanted to, like, young people always responded really enthusiastically to lessons about young people. Mm. And so I would always attempt to incorporate the history of teens and like teen current events into my curriculum. And I'll give like a really quick example. So when I taught civics, I had to do like this in-depth unit on the Supreme Court. And what I did was to increase student interest, I assembled cases that had to do with children and teens.
Got it.
And the kids couldn't get enough. The kids were riveted. So I found that if I could include sort of like these teen agents, these teen actors, make teens the focal point of as many lessons as possible, then there was minimal snoring.
I love that. That's so smart.
Yeah.
Okay. Just last two questions. What's the thing that you hope folks will keep in mind as they're reading Creep?
Ooh, I hope that people will keep in mind that the problems that I'm writing about are crucial. They're ongoing. And the violence that I'm writing about is unfolding in the present moment. And so I want for people to keep that at the forefront of their minds, because so often this type of writing is consumed for entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that while people might be entertained by some of the work, that it also prods people to political action.
Okay, and then here's my last question. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read this book, who would you want it to be?
My grandfather. My grandfather. I so want him to, because like his dream was to become like the most famous poet in Mexico, the most famous poet in the world. So he wanted fame, he wanted renown so badly. Mm-hmm. And so I want him to read this essay that is inspired by him, but that's written by a woman.
Yeah. Joke's on you. I love that so much. I want to say this to folks. I read the book and I listened to parts of it on audio. Miriam reads it beautifully. I was having a hard time. Sometimes I was like, I want to read this essay with my eyes, but also like, I sort of want to hear how she reads it. So I would like go do sections and stuff. So I can recommend both ways to read the book. You can get the book wherever you get your books. It is in the world. Miriam, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This was fun.
Yes, I loved having you. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Miriam Gerba for joining the show. I'd also like to thank Alex Premiani for helping to make this conversation possible. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for September is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dieterer, which we will discuss on Wednesday, September 27th with Brittany Luce. If you love this show and you want inside access to it, go to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. And make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you're listening to your podcasts. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads, and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.